broadcasting from a device built by a teenage genius using leftover parts from an erector set. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to this special episode of the Echo Chamber. Jason Hunt here in studio, along with members of the Gang of Meddling Kids, Allie Ulrich, who
Hello.
Is here. Christopher Jensen is here.
Hello.
Dan Handley is here.
Hello.
And I say this is a special episode because we do have a guest, Mike Climo, who you might not recognize his name, but you recognize his work. This has been circulating around the internet for quite a bit now. The Star Wars ring theory. And Mike joins us today. Welcome, sir.
Hi. How's everybody doing?
Pretty Great. Good. Trying to go through your white paper here. And it's a very well researched, thought out paper that I can see. But we also wanted to discuss where all of this came from. I thought we'd take our first half just to discuss the genesis of the paper and your process for research and finding all of the bits and pieces for comparison. And then on the back half of the show, we could talk about the validity of the analysis, because I'm sure that there are some doubting Thomases out there. There are some people who probably think that Lucas wasn't as brilliant as this paper might make him out to be.
Or think it's like a Dark Side of the Moon to Wizard of Oz or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It could be. Well, you know, happy accidents happen, so that's one of the things that we come up with, right?
I'd say this is a lot of accidents. That's a lot of accidents here.
Well, okay, so Mike, let's just go through a little bit about your process, because I look at your Twitter feed, and I see a lot of comparisons in the visuals between all six of the Star Wars movies and a lot of different classic films, Bride of Frankenstein, Ben-Hur, Bridge of the River Kwai, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get started with this whole idea of analyzing the Star Wars saga in this way? How did you recognize that there was an actual structure that matched ring structure?
Well, that was something that took a very long time, and it happened. It didn't happen all at once. I mean, it was most definitely a process. A couple of years ago, I had planned on developing, a number of essays to take on some of the different topics. I was going to take on a lot of the criticisms that have been levied against Star Wars. I mean, the prequels in particular, and Star Wars in general. You know, whether it's the belief that they were they were intended as kids' movies, that I was going to take on the dialogue, the acting, topics like that. And so I began to do a lot of research. I've gathered a lot of research over the years. I mean, whether every newspaper clipping and magazine article and interviews and. But I started to kind of go through it and catalog it and organize it so I could start these essays. And as I was doing the research, obviously I was going through a lot of the movies as well, and I was, taking screenshots, and because I was going to use a lot of the parallels between, A New Hope and The Phantom Menace and Empire Strikes Back and Clones and then Return of the Jedi and Revenge of the Sith. I mean, a lot of those parallels that all of us, I would say most of us and even casual fans recognized, when we first watched the movies. But as I was doing that, I started to notice parallels that kind of fell outside of that pattern. And a lot of that started with The Phantom Menace. With The Phantom Menace, I slowly started to realize that the beginning of The Phantom Menace very much echoes the beginning of Return of the Jedi. And suddenly, you remember, oh, wow, the end. I think we all kind of recognize that the end of The Phantom Menace kind of echoed the end of Return of the Jedi. And then I took, a look at the middle, and, those matched up as well. And I thought, okay, wait a second. So this seems a little odd. And then still sticking with just The Phantom Menace and Return of the Jedi, I dug a little deeper. And You know, I'd studied, you know, cinema, you know, when I was in college, and I wanted to be a screenwriter, and, you know, I really broke apart the scripts, you know, into their acts, and then into their sequences, and then into their scenes, and the individual plot points, and then I realized that The Phantom Menace, you know, more closely aligned with Return of the Jedi than it did with The New Hope. And again, I thought that was awfully strange, and I wasn't quite sure, you know, what was going on. And then I kind of went on to the next set of movies, Clones and Empire, and then the next set, Sith and A New Hope. And, you know, while I was going through this, I mean, I was recognizing some kind of a pattern to this structure. I mean, just kind of, you can if you break each of these pictures down, you know, in terms of their screenplays and their, you know, if any of your listeners are familiar with screenwriting, with their major plot points, you know, there's plot point one and plot point two.
Right.
And I started to notice that there was a pattern, but I wasn't really sure what, you know, exactly what this pattern was. So I was kind of researching a little bit more about, you know, storytelling structure and a lot of structure and poetry. You know, I know, you know, Lucas has used that analogy before. And then I came across a book by Mary Douglas called Thinking in Circles. I had kind of remembered this device called chiasmus from my college days, from, you know, studying comparative religion and like, you know, biblical poetry. And here suddenly was a book where Mary Douglas, this social anthropologist, you know, broke down this idea called ring composition, which is just kind of a much, you know, more complicated, more blown out version of chiasmus. And then there it was. It was this pattern, you know, of you know, this is called inverted parallelism, going essentially from ABC to CBA. And she had laid out these rules, you know, that you typically, you know, basically these things that you typically find in this sort of, you know, when this literary device is used. So, and again, this all took, literally, it took 2 years to, you know, just over 2 years from start to finish to begin this process to get it online. You know, and once I had kind of realize that this is most likely the pattern that Lucas was trying to utilize, you know, with his six films, then I could go back through from beginning to end, and sure enough, that pattern held, you know, as I was going through and trying to find these correspondences, you know. So I said to myself, you know, well, if the pattern is true, well, then I can go into the beginning of, you know, Revenge of the Sith, and you will most likely find correspondences to the end of A New Hope. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened.
Now, some of these are there other examples besides the Star Wars saga, just to put it into context, what other stories might we be familiar with that use ring construction as part of their story structure? Is there anything out there that we would recognize?
Well, yeah. I mean, I should say, I mean, this is a technique that really goes back, you know, thousands of years, and you know, you'll find a lot of examples in the Bible. You'll find examples in, you know, Homer's epic poetry, you know, whether it's the Odyssey or the Iliad. And sure enough, as I was doing this research, I came across a man named John Granger, who did this very sort of thing for the Harry Potter books, and it just blew my mind, and I believe that the evidence is there to really support that, you know, with how intricate of a structure that J.K. Rowling, you know, put into those books. So yeah, definitely Google John Granger and look at at his work and how he really breaks down those seven books, you know. You have three in the front, one in the center, and three on the back, and how that it follows that exact same pattern. And it was amazing as I was looking into this, because I quickly, you know, as I was going through my process and I discovered John Granger's work, and I was downloading his books, and he, you know, it was just amazing to kind of, it was like we were just kind of doing the exact same thing. We had stumbled across Mary Douglas's book, and we were kind of using her as a, you know, as kind of a way to kind of determine whether this was accurate or not, and it was just really extraordinary.
Well, now some people would probably sit there and hear you say that and think, well, he found a pattern, and now he's making the evidence fit the pattern rather right. than the evidence supporting the pattern. I know there are probably some people. Have you run across very many people who sit there and say, oh, this is complete bunk. You're seeing things what aren't there.
A few, absolutely. I mean, you know, I will say, in terms of the structure, I think the evidence is fairly overwhelming. And I think I had determined what this pattern was prior to, you know, to being able to determine exactly what to call it or what technique it was following. It certainly helped, you know, once I had Mary Douglas's work to help support this ancient technique and say, okay, now I kind of have a fuller picture of what Lucas was attempting to do. It's important to keep in mind, though, that, you know, Lucas has all but admitted this. I mean, if you read in his interviews, if you listen to his commentary, you know, he very much has referred to you know, the saga as an epic poem with patterns that repeat themselves from one generation to the next. It's very clear, you know, and it's very clear when you listen to him that, you know, he designed the pictures in a way that Anakin and Luke's journey would parallel each other. He's talked about how they essentially go through the same things,
right?
And mm-hmm. they just make slightly different choices. And I think many of us picked up on that. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of these parallels are most obvious, you know, when we watch A New Hope and The Phantom Menace, and we watch Empire right. and Clones together, and then when we see Sith and Jedi. Mm-hmm. But what he has not fully admitted is the second pattern, which is what essentially is ring composition, which is what's happening underneath it.
So is there a possibility then that Lucas didn't get into designing the ring structure until he started working on the prequels, or is this something that if he used it 100%, he would have been doing it from the very beginning?
No, I mean, I don't. The purpose of the piece was really to just validate the claim that the pattern exists. Mm-hmm. You know. With all the six films now, I don't really go into when I think he developed this idea. I really think, if I had to put money on it, I would probably say that he probably came across the idea, you know, maybe, you know, during the making of the original trilogy, or maybe just after the original trilogy. Hmm. You know, this is something, just total speculation, but you know, this is something he may have learned from even John Williams, you know, from, you know, Wagner's Ring Cycle, which utilizes this technique, you know, and maybe in many of their discussions about, you know, developing Star Wars as, you know, this kind of grand opera, you know, maybe it was something that they had discussed. I'm not really sure when he developed this idea, but, and I don't think it would even really be relevant or, you know, matter that much to say that he came up with this, in the early to mid 90s before he sat down to really write the prequels.
Just out of curiosity, you've made quite a case for the idea of the ring, of it fitting a ring theory. Now, you mentioned you had studied screenwriting and that type of thing, so you're probably used to a lot of literary patterns type of thing. Are there any other patterns, you know, maybe more minor patterns that you've noticed in the Star Wars saga?
Literary patterns. That's a good question. Well, you know, I will say that it's interesting to point out that you can see Lucas was toying around with this kind of idea of the kind of cyclical nature of, you know, of whether it's political movements, human nature, of the life cycle. You can see him playing with that even in the original trilogy. So forget the prequels for a moment, and a lot of people...
it's the rise and fall of empires, basically.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
The rise and fall of empires, basically.
Right, but if you just look at the original trilogy and you think about Return of the Jedi, Return of the Jedi starts where we began the story. There is a second Death Star. You know, a lot of the first act makes acknowledgments to Earth episodes in Baca in handcuffs, or, you know, there is, you know, Luke and Leia swinging across a rope, or, you know, there's even a deleted scene, you know, with Luke, you know, making his lightsaber and putting it in R2-D2, which is exactly like the way that A New Hope opens when you see Leia putting the plans inside R2-D2. So he's playing with this already with the original trilogy. And I think he just expanded on that when he brought in the prequels, which is why part of that ring structure is you have smaller rings within the larger ring. So, you know, the original trilogy is itself one circle, and then the prequels are itself one circle. And you see that again in, at the end, in Revenge of the Sith. Revenge of the Sith, the beginning makes a lot of callbacks to the beginning of The Phantom Menace.
So basically, it's the repeating patterns you'd find in an overture type of thing.
Right, exactly.
But not just repeating; they're mirrors of each other. When it comes to the structure within the overall ring structure, you've actually noticed that some of these places they're reversed.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's an important point too. I mean, you know, when it gets down to it, I mean, Lucas, as he said, he's making a modern myth, and within mythology, you know, oftentimes repetition and variation, you know, are almost like the bread and butter of mythology. You know, you see these cyclical patterns throughout human nature, and people kind of going through the same things, but with slightly different variations. And I think that was something, you know, that has probably been with Star Wars from early on. I did want to mention one thing, though, in terms of, you know, the doubters out there, because believe me, I know, you know, when you're hearing this for the first time, and especially if you don't know a whole lot about storytelling or screenwriting or cinema, that it can sound just absolutely wacko. but I will say that the more that you learn about, you know, just movie making and particularly screenwriting, you know, when you get down to it, the nuts and bolts of it, I mean, all we're doing is really, you know, we're doing some script breakdowns, and you can kind of lay these plot points out. And when you do that, I think it becomes abundantly clear that the structure is there. It exists in a couple of different ways. I mean, in one way, you see the structure moving, you know, like I said, with, you know, the first movies line up, and the second movies, and then the third movies in each trilogy. But there is that second underlying pattern, which is the ring composition, where Phantom Menace lines up with Jedi, again, Empire lines up with clones, but in a slightly different way, and then Revenge of the Sith lines up with The New Hope. Point being, you know, we can talk about, you know, we can kind of debate about the details, and we can talk about the interpretation of what Lucas was probably doing, but I think the structure itself, I think that, you know, to me, that's fairly given at this point. I think the evidence for just the structure itself is pretty overwhelming.
How significant was the shot composition in your comparison?
In
the theory, basically, all of these shot compositions that you're breaking down, to some would just seem like ordinary, you know, composition choices that a DP would make, but they seem to strongly support that, at least from the writing. So I just wanted to know how significant in detecting that pattern was that for you? Was that where you started? Was the visuals? Or did it come in more into the story and the pattern of this episodes?
It kind of all came together. I mean, you know, maybe the visuals were probably first, but it's hard to just kind of look at something without, you know, kind of knowing where it was in terms of the plot and what was actually happening, you know, within that shot or within that scene or sequence.
Well, and that raises a good point, because after reading all of this in prepping for our conversation here, I've gone back and watched all of the movies again just to see where I could find the parallels and the mirrors and that kind of thing. And during Phantom Menace, the pod race, I'm looking at this, and for the first time, I'm recognizing this as the speeder bike chase from Return of the Jedi. And at one point in the pod race, Anakin gets thrown off to the side, the ramp. He goes up in the air, and he comes straight back down onto the bad guy, Sebulba. And it struck me, I was like, well, wait a minute. Leia did the exact same thing, peeling off, coming back down from high up, firing on the speeder bike trooper. And so I started looking at, you know, I started noticing parallels in the visuals, not just the plot structure.
Getting intertwined as well.
The visuals as well. It's like, yeah. Oh, well, that happened in Jedi. This is, and it really started to make me look at all of the different films in a different way. Mike, your theory has probably redeemed the prequels for me to a certain extent. Not fully, but, you know, it's one of those things where I'm sitting there going, okay, I can sit through and watch them now. But it is a very interesting theory. But, yeah, I notice, and you do point out in your paper a lot of the visuals mirroring each other, like Chris said, where you have scenes that are, you know, the composition of the visuals are either exact opposites in terms of screen movement, or, you know, the compositions are similar. Is that something that just kind of happens as a result of the structure being the ring composition, or is that something you think that maybe they sat down and said, okay, well, they moved left to right in this scene, so they have to move right to left in this scene?
Well, I think people underestimate how much time and effort were actually put into these pictures. You know, I think, you know, as Lucas has said, nothing that you see up there on the screen wasn't figured out. I mean, these things were, you know, it took them 3 years to write The Phantom Menace, and I know that kind of blows a lot of people's minds, but, you know, laying that foundation and having, you know, thousands and thousands of storyboards, and I think, I think very much Lucas sat down with his, you know, with his animators, his director of photography, particularly with his editors, with Ben Burtt, you know, to lay out these specific details. You know, you're right, you mentioned the pod race, and, you know, not only do you see, you know, the same details happening, you know, within these scenes, but you're right, then the shot, the compositions are similar, you know, from up above looking down on, you know, Sebulba versus, you know, Leia up above looking down on the other biker scout. And then you see when each of them actually swoop back down. I mean, it's almost an identical, in the identical frame, and, you know, making, you know, moving in the same direction, you know, from the same angle. And then, you know, and then both the pod race and the speeder bike chase, they both end when two of the characters are caught in that kind of chase ending entanglement. And it's worth also noting that, you know, this also goes to the sound effects as well. I mean, both of those sequences are primarily without music, and they really emphasize the sound of each of those vehicles. Mm-hmm. So, this is just an extraordinarily intricate, you know, way to make these moves. I think when to have to sit down and think about, you know, there's correspondences not just in the visuals, but also in the dialogue and the sound effects, and then there's music cues, and then, you know, the blocking and where the actors are in the frame. And, it's just really extraordinary. Had to be, you know, thought about. You know, this is exactly why I kind of opened up the piece with the quote from Lucas that I did. I mean, you know, and how much of an intricate clock, I mean, these pictures really are. And I know, like, I mean, you mentioned it has redeemed the prequels to you for a point, and I totally get that.
Yeah.
It wasn't my intent. There has been criticism that, you know, as if I were writing this to say, you know, forget what you're, you know, whatever you're thinking is wrong, the prequels really are good. And that really was kind of beside the point to me. I mean, whether you like them or not, or whether you think they're good or not. I mean, this isn't going to really change that.
Kind of going back to
think. I mean, like those kinds of, you know, matters of personal taste are really, you know, only up to you, the viewer.
Right.
This was just really to just break it down in more of a kind of a critical film essay sense than anything else.
What I find really fascinating with the Star Wars movies is the way that with the original trilogy, obviously they didn't have the same abilities they did with special effects as they would in the next trilogy, and they still use the same sound effects, especially when like firing one of the guns or using one of the you know, just like even the explosions,
the lightsabers,
it's like,
and all
yeah,
that.
It's the same exact sound,
right.
Even though, and that really resonates with audiences, I think. And, you know, I was watching the third episode, and you can hear a little bit of Vader's music
right.
when, and, you know, Anakin's wearing all black. And I found that really fascinating. And I think the ring theory kind of really brings that out, how he kind of kept, Lucas kept the same.
Well,
sounds and music.
Yeah, not
and
only because of the story structure, also because, like Mike was saying with John Williams, the use of the sound effects and the music kind of is one of those things where you have some repeating patterns there as well, because each character has their own motif.
Right.
And, you know, John Williams, like you said, John Williams took from Wagner and a lot of other composers to piece this together. And come up with signature themes for your main characters. And I think that probably does serve to reinforce this notion that everything's cyclical, that there are pieces and parts that are used more than once.
Mm-hmm.
Going to see Boss Nass, the Gungan, it parallels the audience in front of Jabba the Hutt.
Right.
I guess the going underwater and being attacked by that underwater beast might mm-hmm. be the Rancor Pit, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so there are those patterns that you start to recognize, and after reading the paper, I was like, oh, now I see it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't see it before. Now, the challenge to me, though, it was harder for me to see it in Attack of the Clones. Because I was looking at it, I was like, okay, where in Empire are we? And I couldn't, that was the one that was the challenge for me to sit and see. Because, you know, I know you had said that there are a lot of things that are flipped, so it's almost backwards from Empire.
You got to run the other one backwards on top of it.
Yeah, and I said, okay, where are we in Empire? Because I kept getting lost. Because I guess I was overthinking it. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. For me, like Empire and Attack, the comparisons there is just the flip side of basically the Republics and the Empires at different heights. You know, the clones come in representing the Republic and Attack of the Clones, mm-hmm. and they're at their height. They're kind of obviously the beginning of the Empire. But when you get to Empire Strikes Back, the clones have shifted basically into becoming a representation of, you know, the darkness of the evil Empire, mm-hmm. and they're attacking the remnants of the Republic. You know, it kind of parallels there, because the Separatists were kind of like the Rebellion.
Right.
Know, they were small, more or less. I mean, it's bigger worlds, but, you know, had the same contact. That's, to me, where you see the flip.
And that's, yeah, and you're right, and that's exactly the kind of thing that Lucas has talked about. You know, and that's kind of one of the things that I like to point out, you know, when there has been some, you know, skepticism over the piece. I mean, you know, again, Lucas, you know, he has talked about these things just endlessly, you know, during the making of the prequels. I mean, you know, he would often use the term visual jazz, which, mm-hmm. you know, is he said this is an idea that he's really kind of been enamored with since even THX 1138, is kind of taking the same story but telling it in a new way. You kind of go off on a riff and you take the same idea but you interpret it different visually. And then you've probably heard him talk about how he has thought of the series as kind of a symphony, mm-hmm. where, you know, it's this kind of musical idea where, again, you might play the same song, but you change the instrumentation, and you kind of play it a little differently visually. So you'll see, and I think that is used to help express that idea of those cyclical patterns of political movements and that life cycle. But But ultimately, I think, you know, what he tried to do is take all six movies and really make them into just a cohesive whole, where it's no longer, you know, six individual movies. It's one, you know, 12-hour, you know, 12-plus-hour experience about the, you know, the rise and the fall and the redemption of Anakin Skywalker. And that ultimately becomes your circle, right? That's why they call it a ring composition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same circle that Joseph Campbell, you know, would use when he would talk about the hero's journey.
Right.
And it's the same circle that, you know, is used for the yin-yang, which, you know, which Lucas has included in the piece.
Right.
So I just think all of these things are just kind of coming together, and I think he found a really terrific way structurally to help express that. And not just tell the story through the content, but then through the form of the, you know, of these six pictures.
And that's something that I want to get into a little bit more besides just the structure, because I want to get in a little bit of discussion about the visual form as well, because you've got a lot of stuff on your Twitter account, comparing visuals, to classic films. And I want to go into a little bit more detail on that on the other side of the break. Right now, we're going to let you hear from our sponsors and give us time to refill coffee mugs and reset our seats. And we will be right back with more with Mike Climo talking about Star Wars Ring Theory right after this. Don't go anywhere.
Our transmitters are made from hand wavium. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Whoa, where'd you get that shirt?
Bought it at the convention last week. It's an atomic cotton design.
Atomic cotton?
Yep, they got t-shirt designs from sci-fi, horror, cult films. All the shirts were really unique and fun. I had to get one.
I gotta wait for another convention, though.
Nope, atomiccotton.com. I ordered a shirt, shipping was super fast.
Atomic Cotton, where Erica and Zach combine their passion for art and film to create wearable art. All original, made with a love for the genre. Coming to a convention near you very soon. Or find them on the web at atomiccotton.com. Atomic Cotton, shirts and art for fans by fans.
Hi, folks. My name is Timothy Hardy, and I am one of the co-hosts of H2O, the weekly show about everything genre that I host with Mr. Jason Hunt. And we talk about pretty much anything you need to hear about or want to hear about or didn't know you needed to hear about in the world of sci-fi, fantasy, horror, science fiction, all these great things that we cover every week. And it is just an opportunity for you to tune in and listen to some really, really fun stuff. H2O, sci-fiforme.com. We'd love to have you listen.
Hi there, this is Vic Mignogna, and you're listening to Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Back in the Echo Chamber, Jason Hunt here, along with Allie Ulrich.
Hello.
Chris Jensen.
Hello.
Dan Handley.
Hello.
And our guest joining us by the Google Ansible, Mr. Mike Climo, author of The Star Wars Ring Theory, which you can read at starwarsringtheory.com. It is 9 web pages. I don't know how much this, how much it is if you print it out, but it is a fascinating analysis of the structure of the first six Star Wars films. I guess we can't say this, you know, the Star Wars saga anymore because it's broadened out so much.
Yep.
Mike, let me ask you this, because we have talked a little bit about the visuals, and on your Twitter feed, you post a lot of frame grabs from other films, things like Ben-Hur and Bride of Frankenstein and that kind of thing, to illustrate some of the visual tones of the Star Wars saga. What's the thinking behind all of that? Is that basically sitting there saying, well, all of this has happened and will happen again? Or are you looking at it from a standpoint of Lucas taking inspiration from those films? Because some people would sit there and say, oh, well, you're pointing out how Lucas copied everybody. But I don't think that's what you're doing with that, is it?
No, I mean, I think, you know, I think if anybody says that, it's, I mean, maybe they're a little confused about how creativity works. No, ultimately, I mean, I do that for maybe the same reason I wanted to write the essay on the ring structure, and that, you know, I think I kind of reached a point where I think there's a great deal of misunderstanding and ignorance about the films and about George Lucas. And, you know, I thought that he, you know, I know it's silly to say, but I was hoping this would go at least a little ways toward giving him the credit I think, you know, he deserves. You know, that this kind of serious critical attention that has kind of eluded him for a lot of his career, you know, not just from Star Wars fans, but from, you know, critics and film professionals and film school professors and scholars. And I just hope that people can kind of see that there's a lot more going on there than they might realize, and it might help them understand a little bit more and appreciate a little bit more. And if not, that's fine. That's fine. But I just, I think, you know, I just hope that people can take just a few more moments and think about what's really up on that screen.
Personally, I don't really need any convincing on the prequels. I enjoyed all of them. I had always wanted to see the universe expanded, so to see Jedi at their height was fantastic for me. You know, every new world was like a great new piece of the story overall. I've always felt that Lucas was a great storyteller, but I can't help, you know, I have to make a confession, I haven't read your entire article. I'm not particularly popular because of that fact, but I read the first, you know, four pages, and I got the idea, the gist I felt of where you're going, and you know, the comparison was pretty obvious. I felt where you're going. Others believe I should have continued reading, and I agree, maybe I should have. But what I saw in it was that, just like we've talked about in the first half, is that you were drawing parallels to more or less composition and story structure, and these are things that are inherent in all good movies, you know, and going back to Ben-Hur and all these other things that have been cited, you know, this is something that happens continuously throughout Hollywood, and I think you're mentioning that, but I'm just wondering, like, how the whole kind of ring theory, you know, to me, that kind of seems a little bit like, you know, I don't want to be too insulting, but numerology, you know, mm-hmm. it's like reading something into something, you know, and drawing a parallel that, you know, anybody can really see, but it isn't necessarily there.
Yeah, I mean, again, I would say, you know, if you read the whole piece, I think, you know, based on just the evidence of what's not just in the films, but also from people who've worked on the films, and you know, particularly from Lucas himself, I think it becomes almost overwhelming to say that the structure is reading too much into it. And whether we debate about what that, you know, why he did it, what was the intention, and ultimately my interpretation, which is kind of what takes up the last couple of pages, you know, that I'm sure is fair game and open to debate, but you know, these films aren't made by accident. It's not like he just sets the camera up and, you know, he walks away and comes back 2 hours later and he has a movie. I mean, there's an enormous amount of planning that goes into these things. And for so many of these points to match up at so many different, you know, parts in each of the six movies, I think it's...
You don't think any of that can just be preferential, you know, setup, the way that he enjoyed writing stories and visuals? I mean, directors have styles, you know.
You know, I'm wondering about that, because if the ring structure holds up, and you can see this in other things that he's done. I remember putting a clock to Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Lucas and Spielberg have always talked about the fact that the Indiana Jones movies were very much inspired by the serials of mm-hmm. the 30s and 40s.
Sure.
Which were all 10-minute chapters-ish. And if you put a clock to Raiders of the Lost Ark, if you put a clock to Star Wars, the first one, I don't call mm-hmm. it A New Hope, I call it Star Wars, because that's what I saw in the theater.
Right.
If you put a clock to it, every 10 minutes, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. Raiders of the Lost Ark is probably the closest, the one that's actually more precise in this than any of the other films. But Star mm-hmm. Wars is the same way. You have a beginning, a middle, and an end in every 10 minutes in those two films. And it does very much parallel the serialized format. If you cut those movies into 10-minute pieces, that's what you would have. You would have Flash Gordon and Dick Tracy mm-hmm. and Buck Rogers and the Buster Crab movies. So I'm willing to accept, for the most part, that Lucas probably had more going on in his head than most people give him credit for, mm-hmm. because he's done this kind of thing before. Now, the other part of that is to look at the timing of elements from the prequels to the, you know, from the original trilogy and the prequel trilogy, like, you know, like Anakin going up in the air during the pod race, you know, those kind of things happen at certain moments in the film. And and Mike, you point out in some of these, some of the comparisons, this happens 35 minutes into the film, and it happens 35 minutes into the other film, and those kind of things, where you actually have in the editing and the timing of the movie, certain scenes repeat themselves in the same place. And, you know, like you said, you know, Lucas has probably had thousands of conversations with his team to mm-hmm. to make sure this kind of thing happens. What does that imply for episode 7, do you think? What are we going to see now? Does this then, are we anticipating then that 7 fits how?
But the thing is George Lucas writing the story for 7?
Well, see, Lucas isn't part of it at all.
Exactly.
So but what I'm wondering is, but Kasdan is involved, and Kasdan had to have been part of those conversations about things.
Mm-hmm.
So could we be seeing the beginning of another ring?
Well, something that I was looking up just not too long ago, we were talking about when George Lucas might have had the idea of making this a ring type of story, mm-hmm. if he had the intention of doing so. Would it have been before, during, or after? And so I just, on a hunch, I kind of looked up on IMDb, look at the writing credits. And, of course, George Lucas did the story on all of them. But on the original trilogy, he only wrote the original Star Wars, Empire and Return of the Jedi. He helped on Jedi, but otherwise they had other writers. On the prequel, it was all him, except for Jonathan Hales was also credited for episode 2.
Right.
And so what I kind of get the idea was he may have decided to do a ring afterwards, and him having the control of the writing allowed him to line everything up.
If I could just chime in there for just a second. I mean, sure. Let's not forget. I mean, he wrote the majority of all 3 of the original movies, though. You know, like on Empire Strikes Back, I mean, Lawrence Kasdan didn't come in until draft 3 of the script. At that point, Lee Brackett was brought on to help with the script originally for Empire, and she had story conferences with George Lucas. They developed a first draft, but at that point, Lee Brackett got sick, and she actually died, and she was not able to continue working on it, of course.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, Lucas rewrote the second draft himself, and then that's when he brought Kasdan in to help clean up the third. Both Kasdan and Lucas have said there isn't a single thing in the final film from Lee Brackett. And something very similar happened with Return of the Jedi, too, where, you know, Lucas had an original script that he then brought to Kasdan to help clean up, and so just keep that in mind, though. I mean, and you know, as Kasdan even, you know, would freely admit, I mean, those movies are all George. It's not necessarily so with Raiders. He had a lot bigger hand in developing those screenplays. But you know, I think Lucas has been extremely humble, you know, in terms of allowing these others to have credit, even, you know, by giving Lee Brackett credit on the final film. And you know, you can read a draft too; it's online. And but you know, but just. So I guess the point is, I mean, so all 6 pictures, I mean, he has had an extreme, you know, hand in writing, not just the story, the outlines, the treatments, but the finished product.
Yeah, I guess what stuck out to me was just the lack of additional credits, those who didn't go in and help him clean up, that maybe he didn't want that to throw off the timing.
That's possible.
Or something like
that. That's possible. Well, see, and the other thing, too, is you talk about influences, you know whether when George Lucas writes the story, whether it's the story as the basis for a script or the actual screenplay itself, like Mike said, he references a lot of things that have influenced him. Kurosawa, of course, he talks about Kurosawa all the time,
right?
But also, you know, Joseph Campbell and these kind of things. Well, see, here's what I'm wondering is if you've got Lucas essentially writing a tone poem, which is kind of what this is.
You're kind of going out on me here.
Can you hear us now?
Yeah, you were kind of going in and out on me.
Google is starting to starting to
be googly.
Betray us, be Google.
Be all googly.
Where was I going with that now?
The tone poem?
The tone poem.
Kurosawa,
that if he was writing that tone poem and his influences, Kurosawa and so on. Google threw you for a loop.
Google threw me. We can cut this part out now that I'm digging for my point.
Oh, man. But you did have one, right?
I had one.
Okay, that's the important thing.
I had one, but I don't know where it went.
I'm not so much like a skeptic of your theory and not having, you know, read all 16 or 12, 9 pages of it. I just felt like that, you know, there were points in it, you know, that I could tell where you were going to go with the theory, and I just felt like that it was much more, you know, of a parallel that's constant in all of cinema, you know, and that it's easy enough to see these patterns in everything, so... You know, I'm just curious as to, like, you know, we did sort of try to touch on it, but, you know, how did you take this journey? I mean, what was the impetus to dig so deep in for several years to write this when you knew there could be some skepticism like this?
I mean, a couple of reasons. I mean, one, I studied cinema long enough to, you know, nothing like this has really been attempted before in mainstream cinema. And two, I thought the evidence was there. I mean, sure. I mean, it's one thing to say that, you know, a lot of directors have their own, styles that, or touchstones, whether it's, you know, maybe, you know, a certain director likes deep focus photography or, you know, it could be a million things, but, you know, but then it's another thing to structure pictures, you know, let's take Clones and Empire, for example, and we all know that Clones opens with, you know, a great Hoth and then ends in Cloud City. It's another thing to then, when you design Episode 2, which is a film that's supposed to correspond to the previous one, well, then you have the film essentially start in Cloud City and end on Hoth. I mean, that's, to me, it's a very deliberate, there's a very deliberate structural reversal there, and I think the evidence is there for it. However, again, why he did it and ultimately what that meaning is, I think that's up for, you know, discussion.
Was there a significant part of any of the films that really led you to this ring theory, or was this really like a slow process of noticing small things, or is there something in your theory that really brings it all together? Just is there one thing, or is it a bunch of smaller things?
Yeah, I mean. Well, kind of when I stood back and when you kind of took a big picture look at all six pictures, and it's kind of what Lucas had talked about, and I believe I quoted him in the piece where he says that each picture has to work on its own and be entertaining in its own right. It's just one chapter in the book, and the larger picture, the book is what's really important. And so when I kind of thought about that, and you kind of take a step back and you look at these six pictures, and you have Menace and Jedi, which essentially kind of work like bookends, and they're linked up. The beginnings match up, the middles match up, and the ends match up. And then you have these four movies in the middle, and the first two. And again, this becomes apparent when you are taking two of the movies and you're looking, you know, and you're comparing them to the other two movies. And then suddenly you have Attack of the Clones, which begins to descend, you know, very literally and figuratively at the beginning of the movie, you know. And I think Lucas was cueing us into that when, you know, it was the only picture that moves in a different direction when it the picture pans up after the opening crawl. And then that, I think, moves into why he reversed that structure of why it essentially starts in Cloud City and ends in Hoth, and why that descending structure continues with Revenge of the Sith, where it essentially ends, you know, with this space battle, and it begins, you know, on Tatooine, you know. And then, so once we've reached that all important middle point where, you know, the most important piece of this entire story lies, we start to then ascend back to the beginning of the circle.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that then take place, you know, just kind of, again, like I said, when you take a step back and you look at the big picture, and then you have these kind of bookends, and you start to descend all the way down to the lowest point, which is when, you know, Anakin becomes Darth Vader, and he gets kind of imprisoned in that suit, and then we move to this new half of the story, and we ascend back to that character's ultimate redemption. That to me was just kind of mind-blowing. It was like he was telling the story not just through the content but through the actual form, the way that these pictures were assembled and how they kind of worked together. And that, again, and it goes back to the kind of filmmaker that he was. I mean, again, and a lot of people forget about who George Lucas is and where he came from. I mean, he came out of that kind of almost avant-garde movement of the 70s, mm-hmm. in the late 60s. Mm-hmm. He was very much, you know, when he was at USC, making abstract films, tone poems, non-character, non-story pictures, right? Yeah, non-visual films. That'd be a real treat.
Well, it'd be great if you're deaf.
But, you know, and so, and a lot of people forget that when he made Star Wars, I mean, he started out doing something entirely different than he had done before. It was kind of done on a lark, and he kind of got stuck into it. So you can kind of see how he tries to put some of these more experimental tendencies into these movies, but while keeping them still, you know, very much accessible for those, you know, 12-year-old boys and girls.
Yeah, and reading your bibliography on this paper, it's very interesting to see, because, you know, Lucas talks about his influences. I remembered my point now. Mm. Lucas talks about his influences, Kurosawa and Campbell and that kind of thing. Your analysis, you're referencing psychology, you're referencing Carl Jung, you're looking at Joseph Campbell, of course, and Mary Douglas, but you're pulling in things not necessarily all screenwriting and story structure. You're actually, you know, you're pulling in psychological profiles and that kind of thing as well. Is that, I'm assuming that also figures into how the ring structure works, because psychologically speaking, you know, you're talking about the repetition of the story. I see the loss of innocence get repeated a lot in these. You have, you know, Anakin's loss of innocence, Luke's loss of innocence, Princess Leia's loss of innocence. The loss of innocence of the Republic falling to the Empire, you know, these kind of things, and I'm assuming that psychologically those would be part of the pattern that we're seeing in these movies. Would that be a valid theory, maybe?
Oh, I think you nailed it. I mean, and Lucas has been very explicit that Phantom Menace, you know, the prequels move from a very innocent place to a very dark place, and then when you attach the original trilogy to it, it moves back to innocence, you know, which is why Jedi and Phantom Menace are easily the most lighthearted out of all six, you know, so it works that way in terms of tone. Joseph Campbell, you know, shot the Power of Myth television series with Bill Moyers on Skywalker Ranch, and they had a friendship for many years. And Joseph Campbell was very much, a lot of ideas on, and again, and Lucas wanted to get into anthropology and psychology, you know, before he moved into film. So a lot of those things have always been very interesting to him, and they've always been in Star Wars. And, you know, a lot of, you know, I would say most of, you know, what is in my essay, you know, has already been said before. It hasn't maybe been all put together in this way. You know, I mean, you know, Anne Lancashire, who I quote heavily in the piece, I mean, she's been writing about this stuff since 1980, you know, and I mean, and if anybody remembers the Magic of Myth tour, you know, and that was in the mid-90s, you know, and even, you know, during that interview, The Power of Myth, and he was talking about some of these things with Star Wars, and especially in the academic world, you know, there's been a lot of academic essays in terms of, you know, those psychological and those mythological underpinnings. In Star Wars.
So what does the machete order do to all of this? Because you talk about the psychology of it, and the structure, the story structure, And there are a lot of people that say, oh, Phantom Menace doesn't matter. You watch A New Hope, then Empire, then Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith as a big flashback, and then Return of the Jedi. Yeah, that's the favorite of the Machete Orders. Does that, what kind of impact would that have to seeing the Star Wars saga the way it was originally designed, do you think?
I mean, I've said this before. I mean, ultimately, I mean, I don't care how anybody watches the movies. I mean, you can watch them, you know, but in terms of the Machete Order, I mean, when you take one of the pictures out, that to me is a deal breaker. And particularly after really digging into what I think Lucas's intentions were, and how that lays the groundwork for everything that you see after it. Not just in terms of the story and the characters, which I think is extremely important, but in terms of the thematic content and how, you know, it's the Phantom Menace. I mean, you can say what you, you know, there are many things you can say about it, but I mean, I think you've got to realize, you know, how much thematic material is there that Lucas is really exploring, whether it's this idea of greed, which, you know, and symbiotic relationships and how that is exactly where we come back to at the end of Jedi. And it really helps put everything in context. And it helps, I think, everyone understand maybe the meaning of the piece and what his intentions were. And without that, I'm not quite sure how you can really read exactly the messages that Lucas put in there if you have one of the pieces missing.
Do you think that fans and academics who may have seen individually or in whole these, you know, patterns that build this ring theory perhaps recognized the pattern, just didn't know what to call it?
Well, it sounds like that's what Mike did. It sounds like you were subconsciously seeing a pattern, but not knowing what it is, because, you know, like you said, you know, reading Mary Douglas's book, suddenly it was like the light went off and bing. I wonder about that, because I never saw any kind of a pattern other than, oh, this visually looks like, you know, something from the original trilogy. But I never clued in on there's a deliberate structural pattern that's being repeated here. I just figured, you know, cinematography was being, you know, we're just echoes. You know, the prequel was echoing the originals just because fan service, and oh, this is that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's exactly a greater kind of like meta, you know, thing that is present that is just there in the story levels. I mean, just look at, you know, even though the middle film is complicated and I can't explain how that one matches up, but the front two and back two, you know, are to me are very clear. Menace and Hope. I mean, those are, you know, obvious parallels to me, and Revenge Return. You know, you can get deeper into the storylines and find supporting structure there, but I think the pattern's always been there.
I don't think I was clear enough in the piece, and if I ever update it, you know, I want to be really clear on that point. So, you know, watching these movies, we all realize that Phantom Menace had a lot of similarities with A New Hope. We all realize that, you know, Clones and Empire had a lot of similarities. You know, asteroid field, C-3PO, hands getting, you know, cut off. And then again, Revenge of the Sith and Return of the Jedi. We all saw a lot of those similarities. And again, and that was intentional, and Lucas was very clear, again, that Luke and Anakin are going through the same things. But, and that isn't ring composition, necessarily. You know, that pattern would just be, you know, if you give each movie a letter and you think of like a stanza of a poem, it would be ABC, ABC. And that's called step parallelism. And that's, I think that was intentional, but that isn't ring composition. The ring composition is when you reverse it. So the pattern is now ABC, CBA. And then it corresponds with all of these kind of conventions of that literary device that Mary Douglas lays out. And there's quite a few of them, and this structure holds up and it matches all of them. So that I think is just, so I'm clear that, you know, that we see, you know, when we watch The Phantom Menace and we see a lot of correspondences with A New Hope. Well, sure, I mean, that's quite obvious, and it's but that's not necessarily what the essay is about.
So have you gotten the call yet to be a story consultant on the next trilogy?
probably not. No, I'm not expecting that. Yeah, and with Lucas, you know, I'm still confused about it. You know, I had read reports that he had actually finished three treatments, actual story treatments for the next trilogy, and I thought those were part of the sale to Disney, and I'm not quite sure what happened when Michael Arndt was working on the first draft of Episode 7 and when Kasdan and Abrams came in to kind of redo it. So I don't know how much is left. I don't know if, like, you know, the overall framework, perhaps, if they just jettisoned everything. But it also leads me to believe I want to know who Lucas has talked to about this. I mean, I'm sure he talked with Coppola and Spielberg, and Ben Burtt would have to know because they edited all. He had helped edit all three movies. But, you know, did he talk with Abrams before, you know, he started working on these things, just to kind of give him an idea about what's really going on, you know, in these movies, and maybe perhaps why he's, you know, been making these movies?
That's a good question.
Let me look this.
We'll have to see if we can score an interview with Mr. Burt and ask him about that. That would be something.
Right.
Now, Mike, are you planning on updating your paper at any point in time, or is this it's done and you're moving on to other academic pursuits?
No plans right now to update it. I mean, there's just not enough hours in the day. I have gotten a lot of great feedback and a lot of great additions, you know, to help lend even more support to it. You know, people finding different things and just really helping me to strengthen the case. And if I ever could just find enough hours to devote to it, I could certainly update it.
Going off of whether or not the story was Lucas's, according to IMDb on Star Wars Episode 7, J.J. Abrams, Lawrence Kasdan are the only ones listed as screenplay. George Lucas is listed for characters, so basically based on characters
based on characters.
So it says nothing about the story.
Well, and I had heard that early on they were doing something completely original. So I saw an article that said George Lucas was going to do this with the next trilogy, and Disney's not. So I don't know if that has any kind of influence or bearing on what Disney's going to do or not. It will be interesting to see when.
It sounds like the story that had to do with, you know, Lucas's treatments had three new characters, all teenagers, not as young as Anakin, but teenagers, and then there were reports that Disney balked at that because they thought it ran maybe too close to the prequels. And I think Abrams, again, this is complete speculation, just based on what I've read, that he wanted to devote more time to the original three cast members.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if Lucas has seen the theory? Your theory?
I have no idea. I know people in Lucasfilm have. I've been in contact with them, and they've been just really really supportive. I mean, and just really said some really nice things. And I was lucky enough. I mean, it was a childhood dream filled to be in the Star Wars Insider back in March.
Nice.
And
we sent an invitation to Kathleen Kennedy to join the conversation, but
I would love to talk to her.
She's a little busy, I guess. So anyway, all right. Mike Climo is the author. The website, StarWarsRingTheory.com. It is, I don't want to say it's a heavy read, but it is an academic paper. So it is, you know, for some, and this is something we had talked about because Tim and I talked about this on H2O, the fact that online reading has made us, has gotten people into the habit of reading in an F pattern. You read the main line on the top, and then you skim the rest of it. Well, you can't do that with this paper.
Well, the thing is, it's a long read, but a lot. It's full of so many good points. If you skim, you'll miss.
It is. It is a very good paper. It is very well laid out. It makes a good case for an appreciation of the all six films as a whole in a new light. So we thank you very much for your time today, Mike. And if anybody out there who's listening, if you read the paper, Be sure to leave a comment, or you can send us your comments either on the post or through an email, echochamber@scififorme.com. You can join us on the social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, Google+, Tumblr, YouTube, and you can leave us your comments and thoughts there. You could also call our hotline, which is area code 573-42-SCI-FI, and leave your thoughts there if you actually want to have your voice on a recording for posterity. And that's going to wrap up for us this episode. I want to thank my panel, Allie Ulrich.
Thank you.
Chris Jensen.
Thanks.
Dan Handley.
Thank you.
And our special guest, Mike Climo.
Thanks a lot, guys. I was probably rambling most of the time, but I really appreciate
that's fine.
That's why we had you, so you could do most of the heavy lifting today. All right. And as always, of course, you can find the latest news and headlines over at scififorme.com. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. We will be back with another episode of Echo Chamber very soon.
This has been a presentation of scififorme.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.